This is March 7th, 1983. I am interviewing Glenn Ringsted, who was a student here in the late 40s at Morehead State University and who is now a member of the faculty of Morehead State. I am Mary Ellen Schmieder, and this is for Morehead State University's Oral History Project covering the years 1925 to 1950. Hello, Glenn.
Hi.
I've been looking forward to this.
Thank you.
There are several things, of course, we want to know, and we want to talk about student life, we want to talk about academic life, we want to talk about why you came here, what the quality of life was on the campus, and as specific as you can be about your memories, the better. The more specific you can be, the better.
All right.
I think the first thing I'd like to know, we may as well start at the beginning, why did you come to Morehead State, and when did you come, and how long did you stay?
Well, the year was 1944, and I came, I think, because it was cheap, because I'd been Concordia the year before, and so I transferred here as a sophomore. And it was at first strictly a matter of finances, although I wasn't sorry I did afterwards.
Did you stay here from 44 on then, or did you?
Well, yes, 44 until 1947, when I graduated in 1947.
Okay. With what degree?
With a BS, majors in English, minors in foreign languages.
Did you have to minor in education as well?
Well, yes, it wasn't formally called a minor, but you had to take the educational requirements. Yes.
So you got certified to teach in Minnesota
as
well?
Yes, mm-hmm, yes.
But your major is English. What foreign languages did you study then?
French and Spanish.
French and Spanish.
Minors in both of them.
Okay, and then you went from here where?
Well, I taught in a number of high schools in Minnesota, Colorado, California, and you want the whole thing?
Well, just give me a quick
okay.
summary.
High schools for about 5 years, and then went to graduate school in California at San Francisco State and the University of California, and then to Morehead State.
Where you've been in the faculty?
Where I've been ever since, yes.
What year did you come here on the faculty?
1961, and I was fed up with graduate school. I had two job offers. One was at Morehead State, and one was at a junior college in Pasadena, and I went to Los Angeles and woke up on a nice smog-filled morning. And decided I wouldn't go. I decided I wouldn't go to the interview and instead phone Morehead and said I was coming back.
You came home.
Yes.
And you've been home ever since,
yes,
except
yes.
for trips to Europe almost every year and all the rest of it.
That's right, yes.
Okay, well, let's go back then. So you were here 44 to 47, which was the time when the campus was very much reflecting what was happening in the country. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship of students or the life of students here and the effect of the war or and then after the war, that kind of thing?
Well, yes. It was the year I first came, 44 to 45, I suppose was the dimmest, darkest year in the history of Morehead State because there was practically nobody here. The Air Force had just left the year before, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Although it might have been the year before that. No, I think the year before.
Mm-hmm.
Which left only, I think, maybe 200 students at the most. Most of them were two-year students getting the two-year education, elementary education degree. And maybe the number of four-year students might have been something like 60, maybe, something like that.
Of which how many were men?
If you cut it down that, probably only 20 were men or something like that. So there are very few men and not all that many girls. And I think the school was really wobbling at that point to wondering whether it could continue or not. The year immediately following that was the year when people started to trickle back from the wars. And by 1947, things were rather lively. So one of the things, of course, it was in the deepest, darkest war years when I first arrived, and then the ending process and the enlivening of the whole scene because of that. I guess that's the most obvious feature of it. I must say, looking back on it, that it seemed protected from the wars. even with people trickling back, the wars didn't seem to have much of an effect on the psyche of anyone, even the veterans who were returning, as far as I can remember. Maybe they were just forgetting it or something like that, but it seemed a place isolated from world currents, really.
So that in 44, the 200 students who were here weren't busy getting letters from whoever had gone off in the Air Force and that kind of thing.
Yes. I think, you know, they knew a lot of people had gone off the Air Force. I just think that most of us continued our activities as if either the war didn't exist or it was going to be over pretty soon. And, of course, there were people who suffered tragedies and that kind of thing, and I suppose their attitude was quite different, but I didn't come that close to anything. It did. Looking back on it, it seems rather strange that it should have been quite as quiet and peaceful as it was.
Now, when the students started coming back after 45, was that men students who came back, or were they GIs with GI Bill?
Yes, mainly that. Yeah, because it was a little. I suppose a little harder to tell whether girls were coming back or not. But I think not in the main. A few of them may have been off working places during the war for the kind of money you could make then. But mainly it was men that came back and started to come back. I think in 45.
Well, did you have a feeling that the men who had been off on the battlefield who were suddenly on the campus were a different breed than those of you who had been here and studying away?
Well, no, I think that's one of the things I was in a meaning. Actually not.
Okay.
Now, that may have been just my experience, but I can remember, the first kind of trickle back. One of them was Bill Payne. I can't remember which spring this was, but it arrived back in the spring quarter, I suppose it was maybe 1945, who had actually been in the intelligence service in Europe, and I suppose was, 23 or 24 years old. He'd been around, had quite a bit of experience. I remember I was enormously impressed because he announced that he and some other GIs had been to Paris to see, to make the pilgrimage to the apartment of Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. And he told us this story about how Gertrude had said to Alice when she played the piano, please don't play either on the white keys or the black, not both. But anyway, I was enormously impressed by this and regarded him as being very much sophisticated and far beyond anything I had experienced. When he dropped into, I think it was the American Literature class, literature survey that he was in. But there were other people like Niles Jefferson, who is now at the University of Minnesota, and I think came back in that same year, who was both an English and a science major. A number of people like that, but I didn't seem to be separated from them in any way, no. Which again is a little surprising. I'm afraid I can't tell you why. But
what's all that reading you had done?
Maybe so.
Yeah. Well, the fact is that you were in the arts, you were in literature and languages, and I suspect had been reading rather broadly for a long time, had you not?
Yes, that's right. Ever since high school, and I didn't. I suppose that maybe the people who came back, those first few that I got to know that in that particular spring when they started to come back, may have been a special breed selected in some way. I suppose if I hadn't graduated so fast, I graduated before the real deluge of people came back from the war. It would have been about the year after I graduated that the heaviest numbers came. I might have felt more separated in that case.
Well, now, about how many students were there here by 47 when you graduated? How many were in your class, for instance?
My graduating class was only about 60, I believe. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the other classes then were becoming larger by that time, the freshmen and sophomores and so on. So it was livening up a good deal. When fraternities and sororities were back in operation at that point and the various social clubs. And
so in 43, 44, 45 they weren't?
No, that's right. There were very few social events. Of the kind you ordinarily associate with college in that year, there didn't seem to much point. There may have been a few teas in the sororities or something, but being a man, I didn't get invited to those. As I remember it, even the fraternity and sorority rooms were vacant and lone once in a while lone visitors would stray around. Nothing was going on in them, that kind of thing.
Hmm.
I think that, yeah, the student life, the social life had pretty much stopped at that point for that year. And even the year before when the Air Force was here, I suppose it was a good deal different. It wasn't like the ordinary mm-hmm. college situation.
Well, what were the students like who were here? What were the select 200 like, the 60 or so who are going on for 4 years and the rest two-year people?
Well, the men all had to be in some way in betweens, or you know, 4F in the draft, mm-hmm. or something like that. So that was a very selected crew. The girls, I think, well, a good many of them were looking forward to teaching in some elementary school. There were still those. I suppose that accounted for 2/3 of the girls, maybe. Mm-hmm. And the rest were students who were getting secondary degrees and looking forward to teaching in high school, mm-hmm. In all sorts of subjects. Some of them were quite interesting. They went on to very interesting things. They weren't here just because there was no place else for them to go. I think they had chosen it before the war started and were seeing it out more or less.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, they were interesting. Tell me in what ways they were interesting.
Oh, well, I remember one music major who got piqued with her teacher, and when she gave her senior recital, made the program double. That is, on the spur of the moment, and because she wanted to seek revenge. So instead of lasting the usual hour or whatever it was, it lasted something like 2.5 hours, and she sang everything. She may have sung the entire Ring cycle, for all I know, because I didn't go to it. And there were a number of these girls. I suppose that the people who are getting four-year degrees tended to have most influence around the campus, and mm-hmm. It seemed, and a number of them were on the Mystic, the writing for the Mystic, and really quite clever, I think, quite cleverly.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was Gene Rakowski, who later worked at WDAY and then went to California to go into the real estate business.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of others went to New York to become models, so they didn't all end up in secondary education. But that's where they seemed to be headed when mm-hmm. during those years.
Would you say that the chief student activity was the Mystic?
Yes. For those people who were interested in reading, writing, ideas, and things like that, it was. And it was the office was on second floor of McLean. And it was usually a center of hijinks and hullabaloo of one sort or another, day in and day out. In fact, night in and night out, the security precautions were extraordinarily informal. And some people, I believe, lived in the Mystic office most of the time. So that there was a constant activity going on there.
Who was the faculty advisor of the Mystic?
At first it was Alan Woodall, who left, and I can't remember the exact year, and then Byron Murray.
Mm-hmm.
But although they advised the paper, they were both down at the end of the hall, way down at the end of the hall in McLean, and the office itself was mainly left to the editors and various assorted hangers-on, I think.
Who edited, do you remember?
I remember that poor Delcy Holmquist, whose classroom was next door, had to come in frequently and still the uproar because her classes couldn't go on. Who was the editor? Gene Rakowski, the first year mm-hmm. I came. In fact, I think the reason I got involved with the whole crew is that she asked me to write something. I can't remember what.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second year, the only two editors I know were Gene Rakowski, Lois Cornell, and then Lois Selberg.
Yes.
And then Lois and I were co-editors during the last year.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So that explains how that relationship got going, that has lasted through the years.
Well, partly it explains
well, it explains its origin anyway.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, now, how did you co-edit?
How did we co-edit?
Yeah. Why were there two of you?
It's a mystery. I don't know. I think it was a matter of perhaps neither of us wanting to do it full time or needing feeling that we needed didn't spend that much time on it. I think it was simply an arrangement like that.
That sounds like you spent most of your time over there.
Yeah, well, actually, not that was one center of my life as a student. The other center was Mrs. Grantham's classroom in French and Spanish. And the reason that was a center is that there were five of us in French and Spanish who were taking the three-year courses in both those languages, and we were together 2 hours a day, 4 days a week, so we got to know each other pretty well.
1 hour each day in one language and 1 hour in the
yeah.
other?
Yeah. Well, no, the 2 hours a day, one in Spanish, one in French.
Yeah.
And the curriculum was organized, so that was three continuous years. And a lot of us spent our time in Mrs. Grantham's office. She had a collection of almost a library on her own. Maybe at the time it might have been better than the actual library in French and Spanish, anyway, and in the classroom. So there was a lot of social activity.
But you read her books and?
Yes, and the books were extraordinary in my mind because she had studied in Paris for a couple of years and brought back these books from France, and they all had there were French paperbacks, which I'd never seen before, but seemed to me very, very exotic. So we learned to read French and Spanish pretty well there.
Yeah, but there were five of you, and so she taught both languages.
That's
right.
Did
she have any other teaching that she had to do as well?
Or? No, she didn't. Well, she had first year, she did every year. And then she did second year Spanish and second year French, or third year Spanish and third year French. So she had four classes each term.
But they were all small.
Yes, they were all small. There were not that many people studying languages, although she had developed one of the reasons I came, it wasn't all finances, come to think of it, because when I was in high school, out at Hitterdahl, the French teacher we had, Annabelle Cruikshank, had been one of her students. And somehow managed to inspire all of us who were taking French in high school with a great enthusiasm for the language and Europe and everything else. And she talked constantly about Mrs. Grantham, the wonderful French teacher she'd had in MS. And so when I came, I was looking forward to that. I think that probably had quite a bit to do with it.
Yes. What was Mrs. Grantham like, other than that she was obviously very congenial and had a good library?
A little hard to describe. First of all, a very good language teacher. When you were learning conversation and grammar, extremely good. A certain atmosphere of elegance, a lady, you might say, not exaggerated or anything like that, and never in the least put on, but nevertheless you knew she was a lady.
Uh-huh.
And although you could have fun in her class, and you could, she wasn't at all straight-laced or anything like that. You knew, there was a point at which you would go too far, and then you always knew it just by a look.
Uh-huh.
So I think a woman who, you know, was really dedicated to the idea of teaching languages, was very good at it, and had this sort of presence of something of elegance there.
Which made you think of Europe and...
Yes, somehow did smack of that, although it wasn't as if she were a European aristocrat or any glamorous exotic lady or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Not like that, but maybe a sophisticated Chicago suburbanite, something like that.
Where was she from, do you know?
Chicago.
Oh, okay. She came by it honestly.
Yes. Speaking about overstepping, I can remember that one time we did something that she didn't appreciate. In those days, there were trains running to Ada, and or supposedly there were trains running to Ada. So Lila Larson, who was in the class, wanted her mother to give a French meal for us. And so we took the afternoon train to Ada, but we didn't reveal to Mrs. Grantham that there was no night train back. And that was supposed to come as a surprise, pleasant or unpleasant as the case may be, but we all paid for that.
Was the meal good?
Yes, the meal was worthwhile. Well, until the surprise was the surprise of the dearth of trains was revealed, yes.
So you all spent the night at Lila Larson's mother's house?
No, what we didn't. That's what we had intended as an escapade, but Mrs. Grantham phoned a friend of hers, and we all drove, huddled in the back seat, drove back to Fargo, 30 or 40 miles, with two very grim people in the front seat.
Oh, dear. Well, now, who else was in those classes? Was Lila both in French and German?
Yes. Let's see. Who were they all? There was French and Spanish.
I mean French
yes.
and Spanish.
Yes. Myself, Lila Larson, Betty Ann Fritzky, a fellow from Dilworth, John Policino, and Marilyn Fay, Murray Fay, Dr. Murray's daughter. And, I think that, come to think of it, Jean Rakowski was in them. How many is that?
That's
five
six.
Or six.
Six
okay, well,
in.
It must have been six, yeah.
Bigger classes than you remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, that. Tell me about those six people. Now, why were they in Moorhead, Minnesota, taking French and Spanish? Was it because they wanted to teach and high school still required languages, or did they have more exotic ideals in mind, or what?
Some of us, I suppose, thought the attitude of the students was not very career-oriented, I must say, at least not the ones I had contact with. Mm-hmm. Might have been because they thought, well, there'll always be a way of making a living once I get the degree. But the people in that class, we very seldom, thought in terms of teaching careers or anything like that. I was there because I wanted to read French and Spanish. I know that, and I had no idea it would lead to a career. I think there was the music major, John Policino, who was there because he was interested in singing. And I think the others were there simply because they were interested in learning languages. And, Betty Ann Fritzky was a science major, actually. Thinking about it as a way to a career, I don't think.
What did Betty Ann end up doing? She majored in science with languages as a background. Did she end up teaching?
Yeah, for a while, yes. And then she went to. She was also interested in religion, so she went to. She went to the famous seminary in New York. What is it? I can't
remember.
Yes, Union Theological Seminary, and. For a time, and then got married. I think I've lost track of her, but I think she's had a good number of jobs in a number of different places. But the teaching thing lasted for about 3 or 4 years, as I remember.
And did the music major end up in a career in music?
No, I think teaching in that
case. He ended
case.
Up teaching.
As a matter of fact, everybody except Jean Rakowski did end up in teaching. She went into radio first and then into business.
Now, Lila Larson ended up teaching, but with various careers on the side.
Yes. Certainly was the most exotic.
Was she exotic as an undergraduate?
Yes. There did seem to be a cluster of characters at the sort of the froth at the top of this whole student body, all of which I seem to have known or come in contact in some way with her in some way or another. And yes, In fact, I think she even managed to get herself expelled, which was pretty hard to do
at
one moment for some sort of escapade or other. But, yes, she was exotic. One of the things she did, well, I can remember one of my first big evenings on the town was an evening in which my friend Bill Payne, the one I mentioned previously, mm-hmm. and Lila, I met them on the street, and Lila had been to some sort of function when she had a costume on, a Carmen Miranda costume. So we all went over to the Waldorf Tavern in Fargo. It was on Main Avenue. Burned down the whole hotel, the tavern, and everything, but mm-hmm. finally, but not that evening, it didn't.
Good, good.
But Lila decided to give a Carmen Miranda performance when the band started playing one of the numbers, I forget which one from that, at the bar. She was apt to do that sort of thing, and she did that kind of thing quite frequently. So she could be what she would call exotic, yes.
Yes, yes.
At least in M.S. Moorhead terms.
Yes.
1947.
Yeah. And now, but she ended up actually living abroad for a long time, did she not?
Yes. She took to teaching and went to California and then lived in Ibiza with the bohemian crowd there.
Mm-hmm. So although the people who came to Moorhead State came from the small towns around Moorhead, am I right? They all...
Yes, yes.
You said she was from Ada. You were from Hitterdal?
Yes, everybody was either, yes, in that class. The hometowns would have been Dilworth, Ada, Climax, Moorhead, Hitterdal. Forgotten anybody?
Rusted.
Lois, yes, from Rusted, right.
Yeah.
Yes, they didn't come from very far away. Yeah. There were a few students who came, but very few.
Mm-hmm. Well, now tell me where everyone lived.
Sorry?
Where do people live? Did they live on the campus?
Well, no, men did not, because there were too few men to have a dormitory, except the last year, I believe, that I was here. I didn't. I lived in rooms very near, mm-hmm. because there were plenty of those. Well, actually, there weren't at the end of the war. It was a terrible shortage for a bit there, and I even remember having to sleep one night in a park because I simply hadn't been able to find a room. But... there were girls, the dormitories for the girls, Comstock and Wheeler Hall, mm-hmm. yeah. And most of them lived there. It was rather unusual to have an apartment, although possible.
It was possible. Mm-hmm. Were there strict parental rules in the dorms?
Yes, there were, and which led to... what we sometimes thought of as a lot of circumventing, but actually not very serious circumventing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it might have been staying an hour too late in the dormitory parlor or something mm-hmm. like that, but not much beyond that, I mm-hmm. don't think so. Yes, the rules were strict.
Do you remember what they were?
No. I think probably... visiting hours were over at 10:30 or mm-hmm. something like mm-hmm. that.
Now, were young women allowed to go home on weekends and so on, that kind of thing?
Or oh, yes. Yeah. They were supposed to check out, though.
Yeah.
And there were such things as checkups about that once mm-hmm. in a while and so on, I think.
Well, now, did most people stay in town all weekend and stay on the campus? Were there any things going on the campus on weekends, or was it a pretty dead place?
I would say essentially pretty dead on the weekends. Any kind of, unless there were not more than once or twice a year, anything going on the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
People did stay in town, though, and the main amusement was, for most of us, was simply getting together and conversation and that kind of thing. It wasn't really an organized activity.
In French or Spanish or English?
Well, sometimes, but with that class, yes, but more often in English.
Yes, and often at the Mystic Office, I take it.
Yes, or there were, you know... people who were old enough or even sometimes not old enough could get into a couple of the bars. Mm-hmm. One of the favorites was the Mill, which was on 4th Street and places like that.
Did students have much money in those days?
No, definitely not. I probably had less than most, but practically nobody had any money. They didn't have cars. They didn't take spring breaks. They had very, very little money for entertainment or anything like that.
Enough for a beer, though.
Oh, yes, yes.
Now, where'd you take your meals?
Well, since I worked part-time at least and sometimes full-time in one job or another in town, I frequently ate at some local restaurant. But there was a college dining service in Wheeler, I think it was.
Could you go there on a meal-by-meal basis?
Yes,
you didn't have to have a full-term ticket?
That's right. You could if you wanted to, but most people did use the dining service.
Did many students work? You said you worked part or full-time. Did many students work?
I would say not so many as now. Mm-hmm. But some did, yeah. But I would say not more than a third of them.
What did you do? I mean, what kinds of jobs were available for
you? Oh, well, I was a hotel clerk, worked in a bakery. Those two things, anyone can remember.
Now, how did you manage that, plus a full load, plus the mystic, plus all this language speaking?
Well, in the case of that last year, I didn't work all that much. So that was the mystic year.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose only part-time. But it got rather rigorous once in a while, but it was possible. You didn't have to make an awful lot of money to exist, really, because everything was extraordinarily cheap. In fact, the first couple of years I was here, even the textbooks were provided from a stock that the library held for all of the classes. And I don't remember what tuition was, but maybe it couldn't have been something like $25 or $30 a term. So you didn't need, if just to keep going, you didn't need a lot of money. And since nobody else seemed to have very much either, it wasn't terribly unhappy making to not have money.
Hmm. Speaking of, wait a minute, what was it? Something clued me in. Oh, speaking of the library. Mm-hmm. The library, of course, was destroyed with the fire of 1930. This is 14 or 15 years later. Mm-hmm. What kind of facility was there by that time? How much ground had been restored in the collections and so forth?
Well, for a little country boy coming from Hitterdal, I suppose it looked like a rather big library, but actually it was a small area in about of what must be about one... less than one-fourth, I'd say, of the bookstore at the moment. And there were two levels. I think they still have the steps that you go up where the bookstore stores old books or something these days. But there were two levels.
Oh, it was where the bookstore is?
Yes, yeah.
Oh.
It was in the back where the bookstore is. Yes, that's right. And there was a counter, running all the way across, separating the reading tables from the... stacks, but you could go back in the stacks. You were allowed to, unless you got on the librarian's nerves. And I was rather impressed because, it's interesting. See, the library somebody had ordered a lot of good 20th century literature. You could there find T.S. Eliot, Proust. All those, mammoth authors of the first part of the 20th century there. Now, in the classes themselves, the literature classes I took, they were never touched on. Mm-hmm. You know, this is, after all, 1940. And,
it's too contemporary.
Yes. It was too contemporary, and the teachers, like Dr. Murray and Miss Holmquist, were looking, they were interested in the past, of course, but... If you talked about modern literature, they were apt to think of the 20s and come up with figures like Amy Lowell or people like that. So the wave of interest in the revolutionary moderns, the ones that we now think of as the 20th century authors, hadn't really hit.
Except for whoever bought those books for the library.
That's right. I don't quite know how they were there, but they were there, and that's where I discovered Proust in English first, and then in French. They even had them in French.
Huh.
In fact, when I came back to teach, I remember in the library going and finding the volume of Proust in English, and my name was still on the card, in addition to two or three others. Apparently, there had only been about four people who dared wade into it.
In 15 years.
Yes. But anyway, there were these books, and it's really more from some of the students who came back and these books that I found out about the great movements in 20th century literature then.
Did you spend a lot of time exploring that then? Did you have a lot of extra reading time?
Or? Yes. I did read an awful lot. It's a good thing that there wasn't very all that much social life, because what I did was, whenever I had any spare time, was read. And maybe did more reading and more important reading at that point than at any other time in my life.
Hmm.
And then there were enough people around you could discuss these books with.
Who were in your English classes?
Well, I mentioned the person immediately comes to mind. Well, is Bill Payne, who mm-hmm. came back and with a certain amount of knowledge of literature and so on. So, and just appeared in one of the classes I was in. So he was a big help. I think. Niles Jefferson, who was the science major and to whom poetry was a great interest, probably turned me on to poetry more than anybody else, because one could talk about that with him. And he liked not the moderns, but all the big 19th century English classics, Byron and Shelley and all that kind of thing, and liked to play games by quoting lines, that kind of thing, see if you could remember which poem it came from. So mm-hmm. we played a lot of games like that. In some of them, Lois was in a number
Lois
of
Cornell
them.
Lois Cornell Seldrick, yeah.
Yes. And one of the big ones was Delcy Holmquist's Chaucer class, mm-hmm. which was a valuable class, and we read a good deal of Chaucer there. We didn't come anywhere near the 20th century, but...
Uh-huh. All right, you've mentioned Delcy a couple of times and Byron Murray. Are they the two English teachers then who were on the staff?
No, there were two others. Mabel Lumley, who taught more or less the classes connected with preparation for teaching in the English department, and Ethel Tainter, who did American literature, I think, in Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about those four then. You were a major in English. You spent a lot of your time there. What were those four teachers like? How would you compare them to teachers today? What did you get from them?
I think Delcy Holmquist, on the side of English and world literature, was the equivalent of Virginia Fitzmaurice, or Virginia Grantham, as she later, her later name, in the sense that she was a person who represented a certain amount of elegance and sort of the grand lady of literature. That's the way she taught, mm-hmm. As I remember it.
Mm-hmm.
And there came, what came across was this, it might have been sort of like a Chautauqua or something like that, but I think it was good for a lot of students mm-hmm. to hear this. And to realize that I think a lot of students got to realize that this sort of thing was important, people who hadn't experienced that kind of thing before. Dr. Murray's classes were mainly in American literature, and as I said, they were quite 19th century. That isn't all bad, of course, because he was good at...
Tell me, did he like Emily Dickinson?
Yes, he liked Emily
so
Dickinson.
So she was already in the canon.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, Emily Dickinson to a degree, but not as much as John G. Neihardt.
Okay, yeah.
And then, well, Miss Tainter's classes were, she did the Survey of American Literature and the Shakespeare. And I don't know if I have much to say about them. I don't put them in a class with the other mm-hmm. two.
Were her American literature people mostly 19th century as well?
Yes. Oh, yes. She was very 19th century. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We never approached anybody like, I can't remember that we ever heard about. We might have had a couple of early Eliot poems, like The Preludes or mm-hmm. something like that. That might, the Boston Evening Transcript, that might just have been possible, but certainly nothing beyond that.
And, so Hemingway and Hemingway
no,
and Fitzgerald?
No,
and
no, no.
Not at all?
Not Hemingway or Fitzgerald either, no.
Did you discover them in the library here, too? Or had you discovered
well,
them?
Actually, I think because of Mrs. Grantham's heavy influence, what I read mainly were the Continentals at that point. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really know much about American literature until I went to graduate school. Mm-hmm. No. I really didn't. I think I read some of them on my own, but I wasn't reading the really big ones. Now I think I was reading Thomas Wolfe, John Dos Passos, mm-hmm. People like that who had a very great reputation in the 30s, but I can't really remember Fitzgerald. I think that was the point at which Fitzgerald's reputation was a little bit out anyway. See, it was in the late 40s and the 50s, wasn't it?
He died in what, 39? I think he...
Yeah, but there was a point at which... if I'm not mistaken, he was almost forgotten.
Yes,
you know, he had been very successful, and then he was forgotten, and then came back. Now, I'm not sure that wave...
Well, he fell into such desuetude at the end.
Yes, that's right. But I'm sure that Fitzgerald would not have...
been on the curriculum.
Either Dr. Murray or Miss Tainter's classes.
Well, now, you said Miss Holmquist was literature personified. Did Byron Murray have the same kind of presence?
Yes. Yes, in a quite different way. I think more the scholar and students liked him a mm-hmm. good deal, although he seemed a bit dusty, I think, to a lot of them. Mm-hmm. But I think they liked him a good deal, and they did learn something about the literature that mm-hmm. he dealt with. Ms. Holmquist's classes... Well, she, again, was more the world literature person, and so she got to deal with Dante and people like that.
Who were
therefore,
important.
Yes, and therefore inevitably seemed a good deal less parochial to, people who were trying to seek for sophistication.
Well, now, you talk about Byron Murray as a scholar, or he came across as a scholarly type. Was there much sense of scholarly types and what the life of the mind was like and what academic life would be? I mean, obviously, you went into college teaching eventually. Do you have any mentors or role models among these people?
Well, not as scholars, I don't think. And that, again, I'd have to go back to the fact that the particular people I knew were here did not think very much in terms of professions. Mm-hmm. They wanted to know about life and were very anxious to experience it.
Good.
And they thought that we just seem to, almost everybody I know seems to be in this classification where most of them are reasonably successful or mm-hmm. at least have managed to keep an even keel. But they don't seem to have started out with an idea, well, I'm going to pursue this in this particular way. The only one, the one who might have felt somewhat like that was Bill Payne, who I mentioned previously, and he did go on to get a master's degree almost immediately and to teach in a college, but he died very young. But even he wasn't... you know, he wasn't your graduate school grind at all, and there was not much of that atmosphere around it. That's why I found it rather, well, when I went to San Francisco State, it wasn't so what I'd call so bad, in the sense that that was a school where there were a lot of different people, and there was a lot of living going on. But I thought, in comparison, if you talk about the atmosphere and the ambience, the fun you could have studying, the graduate schools I've been to, and there are quite a few by now, Chicago, mm-hmm. Berkeley, the University of Bristol, et cetera, mm-hmm. There's something really, to me, deadly about the tremendous concentration on professional success. You didn't. Probably it's because of my background. Nobody thought about this.
Meant because you loved it.
Well, I must say this may sound silly, but the reason I was here is because I wanted to get a college education to learn about the world, to read literature.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound silly to me at all.
Might seem silly, but I didn't think
it probably that. Seems silly to most undergraduates today.
But I didn't think any further than that, actually.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I mean, you were the true liberally educated person then. You were here because you wanted to learn about the life of the mind and
Yeah. No, I must say that this was one of the low points of the school. Mm-hmm. Not that everything about it was bad, as I tell, but it was much more could have been done with mm-hmm. us, I think, if the resources and the time had been right with those of us who were here so anxious to, and so quite lively and ready to learn.
Would you say that the main stimulus came for what happened to you here came out of your own needs and desires rather than out of the inspiration that was given to you by others?
No, I don't think so, although I think that's partly true. But see, going back, I had good high school teachers, actually, and a lot of them came from MS. In the 30s, that's what people went when they got their degrees out into those country high schools. And I had some really good ones in literature, especially, and in French, as I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think they, in the end, did quite a bit for me. And then some of the people, the ones I mentioned, particularly at MS, did too. Particularly Virginia Grantham, Delcy Holmquist, Dr. Murray. I could mention others, though. For example, when I first came, there was Bertrand McGarity, who taught mathematics, and I certainly didn't learn mathematics, unfortunately. I couldn't say that. But he was also interested in music and a wonderful, witty gentleman. So I think, he was only there the first year I was here, but I think he, in that brief time, did a lot. There are others I'm sure I could mention. For example, Samuel Bridges, who taught ancient history, and that's one of the first classes I took when I came here, and that immersed me in a world I hadn't been in before, and I think was quite influential. So no,
How did Bridges teach? What was he like?
It was a question and answer, and as I remember the class, there was me, and then there were a lot of the people who were getting 2-year elementary degrees. So there wasn't much interest. So since the method was question and answer. I think it was dialogue between Samuel Bridges and me. But I was fascinated and almost always knew the answers. I mean, it must have had something to do with him, the fact that I did know the answers and reading the assignments. And I think he was quite a good teacher in that.
Well, that's to the disadvantage of those 2-year students, but wonderful for you.
Yes, it was, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Who else did you have in history?
Well, Joseph Kesey, mm-hmm. And also political science. And there was Paul Heaton in psychology.
Tell me about them as you go along. Tell me about those people, too.
Well, Joe Kesey had a reputation as a martinet and made people stand up when they recited in his classroom, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But he was very knowledgeable about world affairs, and God knows we all needed it. I can remember something really horrible, I was in summer school, the day that the atomic bomb fell on Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about a day later or 2 days later, I think we were in a class in 20th century European history or something. Very few of us. Summer school was even smaller than the rest in those days. Dr. Kesey asked about what event had happened in the last day or so that that seemed to be about to change the history of the world. At least he realized it. I think there were only about two people in the class who had read the papers to find out about it. And he was appalled and horrified, as well he might have been.
Yes.
I can remember it was a tremendous to-do about it. And there was a lot of reading of the papers for the rest of that session, as I remembered. He was quite a
Just
Martin.
In case anything else
yeah,
happened.
Yeah, yeah, yes. You'd think people would have been reading the papers, but I'm afraid that's why I say that the idea of world events hitting the student body that was here. It might maybe when it hit them personally, but not that in the general current.
Now, did you all get convinced by what he said about Hiroshima and Nagasaki that something important had happened, or did that?
Well, see, there again, I had been turned on. I don't know about the rest, because I have been turned on to world events long before. Remember, these are the days when you could hear Hitler's voice shouting on the radio, going way back to 1936. And I had followed because of, I think, my teachers in grade school and high school with tremendous interest, the whole development before this. Mm-hmm. So I had been reading the newspapers and listening to the news.
So what happens to someone who turns out to be a scholar and a teacher in his life starts happening very early, and college continues and allows some opportunity for it to open up, but it certainly doesn't begin here, does it?
Well, I don't. I think the path.
At least not in your case.
Not in my. I'm sure it did in my case. Now, it happened earlier, and that's why I thank God for public education because I think it happened to me. Maybe in the first years of high school, but maybe even earlier than that in grade school, because we had good teachers there, too.
All from MSU?
Well, or Concordia. There were some from Concordia also.
Okay.
But I'm not sure that's always the pattern. I don't really know about that.
Mm-hmm. You had talked about Professor Kesey then. How about the other person you were mentioning?
Paul Heaton.
Paul Heaton.
Well, I think he, I remember him because, well, he taught, he was one of the people who in those days, teachers had to teach a lot of things. And he taught, eventually ended up in the business department here, but he taught psychology, economics, and I believe sociology, I think that what impressed me was the fact that he did seem to be very knowledgeable and a very bright man. I took psychology and sociology from him, I believe. So that although he didn't, I guess his personality didn't seem to come across in quite the same way that the grand dame of the institution did, he was still, I think, impressive.
Who else did you have for classes?
There was Harold Atticott in geography, and good many education classes, of course.
Were you stimulated by the education classes?
No, but I'm a little hesitant about this one because I think education classes have been scorned a bit too much.
Okay,
I mean, it's the whole cliche. And I must say, but see, as I say, when I was a student, I thought of myself as a student and a learner and not as a teacher. And as a matter of fact, I was plunged into teaching rather abruptly because all of a sudden it came time to do student teaching. It was at the campus school in those days. And I was to student teach in English. Well, I was student teaching under Viola Petri, which was a real workout, I can tell you, in English.
Why? Why was it such a workout?
It was a vast array of assignments, including bulletin boards, lesson plans, the actual teaching, observing, collecting materials. It went on and on. In the same quarter, student taught supposedly with Virginia Grantham it was to be Spanish. But Virginia Grantham got sick. That was one of her first illness, her first bout with cancer. Mm. She was quite seriously ill there, briefly. And there was no substitute for that. So I ended up handling the Spanish class all alone the first day, and from then on for quite a while. And not only that, they needed people to teach. She was doing second year French, I think, and at the same time they needed somebody to do second year French. So I found myself for a while teaching the second year French class. Oh, I mean, the university or the college class. And I remember I was particularly appalled because Charles Backstrom, who had been my friend in high school and who had been in the wars, one of the people who had returned, was in that class. So I wasn't quite sure whether to be horrified or pleased by that circumstances. But I did become a teacher rather rapidly then. But I think I didn't really, I'd say sort of unfortunately, but I didn't take the education classes very seriously.
Mm-hmm. But you nonetheless learned how to teach. And
well, I think I did that by being thrown in in the rough, and then I did teach in high school for 5 years. So,
was there anyone in the education department who stood out? I know you say Viola Petrie gave you a real workout. Was there anyone who was assigned as education faculty only who stood out?
Actually, not. I think the dean of men, who was dean of men of that time, Cap Lura, did do some of the education classes, and I think that I remember those as being the most interesting of the lot.
Did you have to take physical education?
Yes, one did. And it was pretty hard since there were so few men. I remember that first year, one of the things that happened to me was I ended up in an archery class for girls. And, of course, I couldn't hit anything whatsoever with the ball the girls were. I almost shot a couple of poor elementary students from the campus school, which very much upset Flora Freak, incidentally.
But you got through it, so you graduated.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because you tried?
Well, I had to go, at least. I remember that was one of the things. You could not go, which would have been my inclination.
Yeah. Well, now, everyone talks about Slivnevsik as quite an institution on the campus. Did you have any experience with him, or was he outside
no,
of your circle?
No, see, he, not during those years. He wasn't here.
He went off with the, with the Air Force group, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he was not on the campus?
No, no.
But Flora Frick was?
Yes, oh yes, very much so. Very
powerful.
Was she
in charge? Was she in charge of everything then, or what?
No, there. Let's see. Roy Domek was here in men's. And there were teams. Somehow they managed, not, God knows I wasn't on any of them, but they did manage to keep these teams going during the whole time, I think.
Women's teams and men's teams?
Well, I'm thinking about them. Yes, women's teams. But I'm thinking about the men. That's the one that would have.
Yeah.
But
so they
didn't collapse completely. No.
So they still had football and basketball, for instance.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And conference play or whatever.
Well, at least basketball. And I don't think football. No.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Mm-hmm. Now you said Flora Frick was a very powerful woman. What do you mean by that?
Oh well, she was commanding in the sense that she could. Regiment you into some attitude of awe or other. She also had a very, very wonderful sense of humor. And she had a gruff exterior, I think. Once you got beyond that, she wasn't forbidding at all, really.
Well, who were the administration when you were here?
Well, really... it amounted to the president, who was Otto Snar, and right below him would have been the dean of men and the dean of women. That was Cap Lura, and then Jesse Askegaard, the dean of women. And that's what the administration was.
How about the registrar?
Oh, yes, there was registrar was Jesse Owens. All right, there was a registrar, right.
And I understand that she was quite a personage, too.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah.
What sense did you have of administration or of leadership for the college? Was the college making a statement about itself to the larger world at that time, or was it concerned about internal matters, or was it just keeping going? Or
well, see, again, there's, as I said, there's a great difference between when I first got here and then what has started to happen the second and the third year. And the first year, I think it was just barely trying to hang on, because the good teachers that it had at that point, almost all of them, like Bertrand McGarrity and so on, at least the younger ones, the ones who had not been here during the 20s and all the time during the 30s, were looking to go elsewhere.
Because the college was so small, they couldn't
stay? I think so. Well,
what?
I think maybe they wanted to get out, and some of them wanted to get out in the world, but there was a lot of opportunity, of course, at that point, because as the war was ending there, people hadn't been trained, and there were all the colleges were experiencing this growth in enrollment. So on. But I think that then after that year, people started to look at the administration, started to get the faculty look at the curriculum and so on in terms of the fact that the facts of the case, that they were going to have a lot more students and so on. And Otto Snar's big thing was general education. And from then on until about 1955 or thereabouts, there was a great emphasis on developing a general education program in the sciences, in the humanities, that would meet high standards and so on. Now, I didn't get in on much of that simply because it was just beginning about the time. For example, the famous humanities course that was instituted here, which was a sort of interdisciplinary view of Western civilization. I think it was given for the first time the year after I graduated. And there were five teachers, Paul Heaton, he taught humanities too.
As well as everything else.
And Elsie Holmquist, and somebody from art, I think Matilda Williams. And there are probably a couple of others in that. But that was one of the big innovations. And the course lasted for a long, long time, way up until the 60s, and I think was a very good thing for Morehead State.
Was a committee working on that then the last you were here, but they hadn't begun teaching?
That's right. I only heard about it from friends who stayed a few years after I did, and the fallout from it at all. At first, the students were horrified because they'd never... It was a new course, and they felt it was a new requirement, but I think all in all, it was pretty successful. And then I don't know exactly what the details of all the changes were, but the same thing was an equivalent, rather, not the same thing, but the equivalent was done in the sciences. And I think in the social sciences. So that the college in those years got quite a reputation for its general education program. I think that was Otto Snar's main thrust. Mm-hmm. But during the years I was here, that had barely, barely begun.
The Dark Ages.
Yes.
What was Jessie Owen like?
I don't think I didn't know her very well. I only remember her efficient and pleasant lady, I think.
Did you have chapel exercises?
Yes. Convocation. And yes, they were to a degree religious, as I remember. Yeah. And they were required. And the dean of women would frequently go around before chapel, or even the first 10 minutes of convocation. It was held in the Weld Hall Auditorium, of course. Into the lounges and various people to see if anybody was hanging around. That might be... dispatched off to the convocation.
How formal were they?
Quite formal. Usually there was some sort of singing, patriotic or religious, and a speaker. Quite good speakers sometimes from off campus.
Who would they get?
Oh, I can't remember right now. But, you know, the journalists or lecturers who might have been in Fargo-Moorhead.
Were they people from the community or were they...
Not usually, no.
...types who were coming through for some reason or other?
Mostly. And I imagine a few of them, I don't know this for sure, but I suppose some of them were invited here specifically for the purpose, but I think, mm-hmm. think a lot that who were here for... Mm-hmm. some other reason.
How many days a week did you have convocation?
Just one on Wednesday. Uh-huh. Same period, 10 o'clock Wednesday, mm-hmm. that we reserve vacant these days, supposedly.
In case we have.
Actually, wasn't. I don't think it was a bad idea, all in all. It was a kind of center mm-hmm. for the week and for the college and mm-hmm. so on.
Did Snar officiate?
Not always, but frequently. A faculty member might, or depending, you know, there might have been, I suppose some of them were simply student events, you mm-hmm. know, the kind that...
Did Snar have, what kind of presence did he have, or what kind of leadership did he offer?
Well, of course, he did manage to get some kinds of reforms in curriculum and so on mm-hmm. through. I think, well, not without some unpleasantness, and maybe more unpleasantness than would have been necessary. And I think, in general, he was something of a martinet, and not a very outgoing one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But academically interested rather than, say, public relations or
yes. Mm-hmm.
Was he much of a public speaker?
No, not actually. I don't think, you know, bad or anything like that, but not...
You don't know what his academic training was, do you?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
Yeah. So he obviously, you didn't have a sense of the campus...
No.
Was focused or its energies were galvanized by him?
No, not from the viewpoint of we who were students. It was the faculty that mm-hmm. Provided the image of the campus and mm-hmm. the leadership more.
Mm-hmm. Now, we call it the Dark Ages, which isn't quite fair, except that you said that it was a dark time for the campus because it was small and everything. If you were to... say, compare the kind of education you got at Moorhead State in those years with what you might have gotten elsewhere, insofar as you know about that, I mean, from talking to other people when you got other places. How would you rate the place, or how would you sum up what happened to you here?
Well, a lot happened to me.
Yes.
But I think... See, I would say that I don't know how many times better the university is now than mm-hmm. it was then. Not that there weren't some good people doing good work, but the resources and the possibilities were just too limited in that particular point. So I don't think in any way, insofar as a university, by its formal organization, its curriculum, and so on, it could rank very high, and yet things happened. You know, mm-hmm. even weak as it was at that point, things happened here. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I'd sum it up. It mm-hmm. that's a bit comforting in a way because
absolutely.
It seems even when a public university like this, a state university, is at its lowest. Something can happen anyway.
That's right.
And it did a lot, even in those very weak years, for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm.
Well, some of the people who have come back here to teach and who have been very, very strong teachers have come mm-hmm. out of those years.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
When you went, say, to San Francisco State or Berkeley, did you find that yourself disadvantaged by having a Moorhead State background?
No. Not...
That's one test.
Unless people looked at my degree and said, Moorhead State College, where the hell is that?
Yeah.
That, you know, or Moorhead Teachers College, it was. No, actually not. With the French I had, I took graduate courses in French and didn't have any trouble with it.
Disadvantage at
all?
No. Yeah.
And certainly not in English literature or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good test.
Yes, in a way.
Can you make it out in the rest of the world with what you've been mm-hmm. what you've been able to mm-hmm. get from where mm-hmm. you've been?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, were you required? Let's go back to the curriculum a little bit. Generally, were most of the courses required? I mean, was there a strong series of required courses set out for majors and minors and so on, or did you have a lot of choices?
Well, I think we might have, in the major, we might have had more choices if at that point they'd been able to have more teachers. But actually, there were very few teachers, and therefore not all that many courses on any given terms list. The requirements were, so I remember it in general education, you needed to take three courses in science, and they had them, there was one called mathematics and astronomy, and then there was physics and chemistry, and then there was biology, and you got, in the course of the year, a smattering of those. That was revised with the,
with the general college curriculum.
Then, you needed to take, I think you had more of a choice in history, although I think you had to take American history. I don't remember for sure there. And the humanities, part of it was things like art appreciation and music appreciation. So those were the general education requirements that were in effect when I first came. The English major consisted of a quite traditional sort of thing. It was a survey of world literature, a survey of America, two quarters of American literature, a survey of English literature, of course, and then choices. You could take Dr. Murray's course in modern American poets, or I think the Shakespeare one, as I remember, the Shakespeare course was required too. Chaucer, Milton, and then the language programs, there was the first year, the second year, which was reading and conversation and a review of grammar, and the third year in both cases was something that they don't do now. I believe there was a survey of Spanish and French literature, and we read a lot. We read plays, we read novels, went all the way through the two literatures. So that was fairly substantial, I think.
Yes. Did the faculty give you time outside of class?
Yes, at any time. Yes.
A really collegial sense around here.
As I mentioned, I think if we weren't in the newspaper office, we were spending, some of us at least, were half the time in Mrs. Grantham's office. And I think they were all mostly like that, yes. If you wanted attention, you certainly got it.
Now, all these people who were here for the two-year degree took the music and art appreciation and the science course and one literature course, or what did they have to do?
Well, I think that varied, and many of their courses were constructed with the idea of having teach in elementary, and I think, for example, not music appreciation. Mm-hmm. I think that was, they had a music course, which probably involved reading notes and that kind of thing, as I remember it. I'm not sure about that, though. No, that curriculum, not in all cases, but was rather separate.
Mm-hmm. So your classes were all fairly small, then, I take it?
Yes. Oh, yes.
What was the average size of a class?
Well, I don't know about the average. I wouldn't say there was any more than 30 or so. And then a good many that I had were down to 5 or 6 or something like that. So they were all small.
Are there some other things you'd like particularly to talk about that we haven't gotten on to?
Let's see. I don't know if there's anything that comes immediately to mind. There were some cultural events, but they were so rare compared to what they are now. For example, at one point Sinclair Lewis visited the campus that I remember, and this was after a great dearth, when nothing had happened, I think, for a couple of years. And I remember it was rather sensational because he was, I think, partly drunk, as he had a habit of getting, and the elegant Miss Holmquist had to escort him around.
Okay.
And there was some kind of tea that I was at, And I think most of us were really tongue-tied in the presence of the great man. We all knew who he was. And that was when he was living at Duluth, I think, mm-hmm. during that period. And I remember him... Well, finally, there was silence. It was supposed to be a conversation between the students and Sinclair Lewis. There was quite a bit of silence. So finally, I've been reading W. Somerset Maugham at that point. It picked up of human bondage. And so out of sheer desperation, I asked him what he thought of that book of human bondage. And I remember his saying, W. Somerset Maugham is a very evil man. And letting it go at that. And the dead conversation stopped dead. I'm still trying to figure out why he could have meant a lot of things. I realize that. I'm not quite sure what he meant. But anyway, there was that. Of course, that was connected to speeches. And I mean, he gave lectures and so on. Then there were musical events. In fact, the one thing that really impressed me the first year was that Bertrand McGarrity, who played some string instrument and got some of the music faculty and gave a series of chamber concert evenings that were really rather nice and was my first introduction to something like that. And then there was the occasional Minneapolis Symphony at that time concert.
Would they come to Weld Hall then?
Yeah. Well, no, they were in the Moorhead Armory, actually.
Oh,
it was
okay.
A dreadful place, yes. But that was probably the only place big enough. And there was an attempt at what equivalent of our fine art series, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. So, but these things were quite rare. They were really an event. And you didn't have the feeling you do now that, oh, my God, I've got to go to something else tonight because there are probably six different things you could go to. Not at all like that. They occurred every other month, and mm-hmm. then people went to them, I think.
So the audience was always good?
Yes, it was usually.
What were the relationships between this campus and other campuses in the region?
Well, you know, very little with Concordia, I'd say, and very little with NDSU. I think much more... isolated.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't go back and forth with students from the other campuses or anything?
No. Actually, I knew a few people from Concordia, but that was because of rooming house situations mm-hmm. and things like that. Really very little, very, very, very little contact, I think.
How was Moorhead State seen in the town? Were there good town and gown relations?
They certainly weren't disturbed, mm-hmm. I don't think. But there was a tendency, of course, I think, to regard Concordia as a somewhat higher class. I don't know if it was at that time. I mean, it was going through quite a few of the same problems that Moorhead State had at mm-hmm. that point. But I think there was that tendency in the town, but I don't think any disapproval of MSU or anything, or MS Moorhead State teachers.
It was the Wicked State University or anything.
Well, no, but there was very little, I think, no, that certainly wasn't there. It was not Wicked, because it was very, very conservative, at least insofar as anybody could tell.
Mm-hmm.
The students, some of them, were not all that conservative, but... Mm-hmm. As far as the official stance of the administration or the mm-hmm. or the faculty or the curriculum or anything like that was very, very mm-hmm. conservative.
Do you have one wonderful final anecdote about some of the friends you had here and what life was like or that would sum up the quality of the experience?
Oh, I don't know if anything that... to sum up, well, that's difficult. I do remember one of the most embarrassing things that ever happened to me, one of those escapade things, which I think is kind of funny. See, as I mentioned, I was worked at the Comstock Hotel, which is now torn down, but mm-hmm. one part of my job was to be a night clerk. Well, Ms. Holmquist stayed there at that time.
She lived there?
Lived there, yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. And, next year I had some, I guess I stopped working there, yes. But the next year I remember there was this challenge one night about a drinking challenge. I don't remember what amount it was, but anyway, consuming a pint, a quart of whiskey or something that was thrown at me. And so I did it. I didn't go in for drinking, but had confidence that I could probably drink any amount without, suffering from it. But that night I did, so I barely managed to wobble down Center Avenue to the doorway of the Comstock Hotel, where I simply slumped down and was out cold. And when my eyes opened, there was Miss Holmquist going in, coming in from someplace, going into the room.
And she said?
She said hello and passed on. And I sort of got to my feet and just quite suspicious looks at me for some time. But there was that kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. But the life of students rarely got out of hand in any way that would attract the public notice.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Glenn. It's been delightful talking to you.
You're welcome.